Hi everyone, welcome to episode 106 of the Let's Talk Yoga podcast. I hope you are doing well. I did take a very short brief break from podcasting. It was mainly because of two reasons. One is I was undergoing a little bit of voice strain. If you've been following me on Instagram, you've seen me talk about it. And with the studios and classes, I really don't get to rest my voice as much as I would like to. So that was a reason why I stayed away from podcasting. I would really sound like a It would sound terrible if I was trying to record during that time. And I am in that season of our Pranayama training and immersive program. So it's been a pleasant, busy season. We're wrapping up the year at the studios. We're looking at every year end. I sit and look at a year in review and what 2023 can look like for us. And I get really excited about projects I want to work on, what I want to do in the continuing education space, what we want to do at the yoga studio, what do we want to do with our team of teachers and alumni teachers, and just there's so much going on in the dance studio. So in general, it's a very exciting season. And so I've been kind of missing dropping a podcast every week, but now we are back and I'm back with some of my favorite guests again to kickstart the season. And I hope you are doing well and that you are really enjoying this year end and making it worthwhile. On the show today, I have Prasad Rangnekar, who needs no introduction. Okay. I believe he has come on this show so often that it's one of those guests that I just need to say the name and everybody hits play right away. In this episode, we talk about Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga, okay, the eight-limbed path of Patanjali. I was keen to do this topic with Prasad because there is so much confusion and surface level knowledge and understand, not even knowledge, surface level information sometimes about the eight-limbed path. And a lot of times, you know, in modern yoga, popular yoga, we think the eight-limbed path is the main thing for yoga practitioners and teachers to know about. And a lot of context usually goes missing. So Prasad and I sit down and talk about the eight-limbed path. We explore everything from how is this where you begin and how linear is this. We discuss the margas, the paths of yoga in relation to the eight limbs. Is the eight limbs for everybody? Is it different for a yogi versus you and me? The yamas and niyamas, and where does one start? And then we dive deeper in conversation and context. It's not just about here's step one, here's step two, here's step three. It's not that type of an episode. I really think you will find a lot of insight from Prasad's responses as always. I encourage you to listen to this, whether you think you know the eight limbs or not. There is context in here that we should all revisit ever so often. So I hope you enjoy it. As always, if you do get value from these free podcast resources that we create for you every week, please take a moment to rate and review the Let's Talk Yoga podcast. You want to follow and support the work of the guests who show up on this podcast, and leaving a review and sharing this or rating it on Spotify will help us get this content in the hands of more yoga students and teachers. And if you haven't been following on Instagram, now every episode of the yoga podcast is available on my YouTube channel. You just go look for Aham Yoga. And there is a podcast playlist called Let's Talk Yoga. And we have converted all these 106 episodes into video podcasts. Okay. And going forward, you will see video conversations of the guests and us talking about these topics. And they're already on YouTube. We've started dropping them. And I would highly encourage you to subscribe, especially if you are using these podcasts as teacher training resources, okay, or your own continuing education. Then if you're a little more visual, then the YouTube playlist might be a good option as well. Okay, that's it, my friend. That's all I have for you in our introduction. I will see you on the other side. Enjoy this conversation with Prasad Rangnekar. Hi, my name is Arundhati and you're listening to the Let's Talk Yoga podcast. I'm an ex-Bollywood dancer turned yoga and wellness educator. I've built a six-figure business as an immigrant, woman of color yoga teacher with no business background, no handstands, pure instinct, and the free information found on Google. If you love doing yoga and you dream of teaching it someday, this podcast is for you. We go over everything from doing and teaching yoga to scaling a small business, living a modern yoga lifestyle, and so much more. You'll find interesting, fun, raw conversations along with some tips, tricks, strategies, and insights in this podcast. So grab your cup of chai and let's jump in. Hi, Prasad. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Aru. Thank you for having me back.
It's been a while, so this is long overdue, and I'm so glad you are here today. We're going to be diving into the eight limbs of yoga. Mm-hmm. This particular topic gets a lot of limelight in general, but I feel like we skim over it often in popular yoga. So I was hoping that, you know, we could have a conversation today about the eight limbs, contextualizing it a little more. And generally, where do you think we should start this conversation? Do we start with an overview of the Ashtanga Marga of Maharishi Patanjali? How central are the eight limbs to yoga itself?
The best way to start this conversation would be to inform the audience that yoga is not a single ideology emerging from one book spoken of as one philosophy by one person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a complex body of knowledge that has evolved over thousands of years through interaction of diverse ideologies, through impact of various social changes, through the vision and voice of different spiritually elevated people. So it's yoga as a body of knowledge is extremely nuanced, layered, and complex. So it'll be too simplistic to say that yoga is Yoga Sutra, or just because Patanjali says something in Yoga Sutra, it means that is yoga, is also not right. Would be not a complete picture. Yeah. So I can say, since we want to start off from the fundamentals, that in a generic sense, yoga is a term given to spiritual thoughts and path, or as you call margas. Marga in Sanskrit means path. And usually in India, we say yoga marga. Yeah. We don't say yoga types or styles. We say yoga marga. So bhakti is a marga. Jnana is a marga. Okay. And like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yoga is a term given to spiritual thought and paths emerging from Indian subcontinent. And the purpose of yoga is spiritual development, spiritual evolution. So that's the main goal of yoga, is spiritual development. All four religions of India, Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism, Sikhism, they have their own paths, you know, ideologies of yoga. They have their own yogas. So there are yogas, which you could say are principles, methods, practices mentioned in Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism. And Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga is one model of self-evolution emerging from this Indian subcontinent. Again, Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga, because there are Ashtanga Yogas of other people, other texts also. So Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga is not the only Ashtanga Yoga. Okay. So you have to understand this, that Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga is one of the many models of self-evolution or spiritual evolution. One could say that this model was one of the first and is one of the most comprehensive model to systematically lay down methods and practices of self-realization. And that's why it draws a lot of traction, because it is systematic. It was one of the first to give an entire framework of how to go from, you know, like the zero to
the start to the end.
Yeah. Alpha to Omega. This is why it is important. That is, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra is important and is counted as one of the six main philosophies of Indian or Vedic philosophies. In this sense, it is central to yoga in general. But I have to say again that Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga is not the only yogic model out there. There are other models too. Other saints, mystics, scriptures give their own models. Like like Hatha Yoga has six Shadanga Yoga, six limb model, and then Gheranda Samhita, one of the fairly recent books on Hatha Yoga, gives seven limbed model. Okay, so there are different angas, limbs, and different models. So this is just a brief to put things in context. Coming back to what I said, yoga is not one ideology, and it's not an ideology of one book per se.
So that's really important that you bring it up. Also, I think because this seems like and I'm doing air quotes, seems like a list, you know, step one, step two, step three. So it's kind of gotten, at least here in America, because things are so linear and everybody likes it in a certain way, the eight limbs jump forward over everything else and the margas of yoga get ignored.
Yeah.
So that brings me to something I want to ask you. Can someone be a bhakti yogi, for example, okay, be on the path of bhakti or any other path and still need or use the eight-limbed path? Because to me, this makes sense. Everything is interlinked. But sometimes people think you have to be only on this path or you only have to take the eight limb. So can you be a karma yogi, a bhakti yogi and still be on the eight limb path?
I mean, of course. You know, like for example, if you say, I want to practice only Patanjali's eight limbs. Okay, then practice Ishwar Pranidhana because he's mentioning it. Yeah, though it's not a part of the eight limbs per se. But Patanjali has mentioned Ishwar Pranidhana. Yeah, it is one of the aspects of Niyama. So, Ishwar Pranidhana is what? Surrender to your own beloved date. So, Bhakti Yoga component has come in. Now, just because you say, no, I'm not a Karma Yogi, I'm only practicing Ashtanga Yoga, but you are actually doing something, no? You will sit in asana, you will do your pranayama, you will try to restrain your senses as pratyahara. So you're doing something, no? So that becomes karma. Karma means action. Mm. So ultimately you will become karma yogi. So these are not silos. These are not isolated boxes that you say, are you a bhakti yogi? Okay, I am a karma yogi. It's not like that. Even bhakti yoga and karma yoga. If you are a devotee, you will not sit at home and want God to do everything for you. You will step out and act in faith. Now, if you are a karma yogi, you need a deeper belief in something that is bigger than your ego. So that is bhakti. So again, I want to say that these things are not isolated. You know, yoga paths or margas like bhakti, karma are all leading to the same goal of self-realization. You know, and in simplistic terms, I know self-realization sounds like some very mystical kind of a process, but self-realization is nothing but coming out of ignorance of who you truly are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So these limbs or angas are nothing but stages through which one evolves towards self-realization, you know. So Patanjali gives eightfold path. And someone else gives a sixfold path. It's like there is one floor and sometimes there are eight stairs and sometimes there are six stairs. So it really doesn't matter. You know, you should not read too much into the number of stairs, you know, number of limbs. You have to look at the direction.
Got it. No, I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah, direction is going from alpha to omega, going from a complete state of spiritual ignorance to no spiritual ignorance at all.
Mm-hmm.
Though I have to say that different paths, different margas emphasize different variables, like bhakti path primarily works through faith, devotion, loving devotion, while hatha, the path of hatha, emphasizes breath control. Yeah, so they have their own, you know, it's like we both want to go to the airport. I'm going to take the train and you're going to drive your own car and somebody's going to hail the Uber. It doesn't matter. You know, yeah, somebody will reach earlier and this and that, but we will reach the airport, same airport. You know, it's really like that. And scriptures also mention that ultimately these are all different paths. That's it, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the reason I ask that is because a lot of times, at least here, the people I interact with, they think it's all isolated. So I'm glad you clarified that. So does everyone who does yoga today need to practice the Ashtanga Marga? Do we all need the eight limbs? Or can some people just practice, say, the Bahiranga, like just a few limbs? And how do we understand, if we zoom out a little bit, the eight limbs for a yogi versus the eight limbs for somebody like me or someone walking into a regular asana class at a yoga studio?
If you look at the eight limbs or the angas of Patanjali's yoga or any, for that matter, any system, you will see that they start off with an externalized mind and move towards a totally internalized mind. So there is a certain direction. Why yama niyama are to be practiced in social context, and why dhyana and samadhi happens completely within. As one philosopher calls it, it's entasis. It's not ecstasy, it's entasis. It happens within. So the movement is from an externalized mind or externalized awareness to a completely focused internalized awareness. Because the main job of any yogic system is to erase that avidya, erase that spiritual ignorance. And where is the ignorance? We all carry spiritual ignorance within the deep recesses of our mind. So all paths start from outside and will end inside. But who starts from where depends on where that individual state of mind is. This is important. Depending on where the seeker's mind is at, they should choose from where to start. If one's mind is already calm and can stay focused for long periods of time, like a dhyana state, then they can start from dhyana. Patanjali himself says it. And this happens to some yogis. This happens to some yogis who have done much work in their previous lives and are naturally taken to meditation in current life. They are born with a calm and centered mind. They, as technical term would be, a sattvic mind. They are born. They are not rajasic. They are not tamasic. They are mature enough
spiritually evolved?
Yes. Spiritually evolved. So such seekers straight away go to yoga of samadhi. That is the first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So Patanjali in the first chapter says, don't do anything, abhyasa vairagya abhyam tandya. So just do abhyasa and vairagya, that much is enough. So their mind is so refined and focused that they just sit and close their eyes and they're already in dhyana.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you come to India, or you may have read stories, or there are lots of stories available, that small children immediately going in dhyana, sleeping in samadhi. So they're already, they're evolved that way.
Mm-hmm.
If one's mind is scattered on the and all over the place, then they need to start with yama and niyama, more outwardly practices, because they are not ready. They cannot sit still even for 5 minutes. Not because they cannot sit still physically, because the mind is so restless. The mind wants to run outside.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to engage first in more external practices, literally pull their mind from outward orientation to inside them. This is also mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, by the way, where Krishna says that those whose mind is not regulated work through action. Now, action means what? To practice.
Karma.
Your practice every day. Fight the tamas, fight the laziness, and get up and show up and all that. These are struggles of a person, a seeker, whose mind is external. But there are seekers who have either trained themselves or who are born with a mind that is, they just shut their eyes and gone like this.
Steady.
So they are already mature.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends. Like, you cannot say, it's not like... It's not like everybody starts from the bottom. No, it depends. It's
that one size fits all approach.
Yeah, it's really kind of, competence based. And that's why I like it. It's competence based, like it's merit. So what are you?
Got it.
You know, like even in school systems, some children are brilliant intellectually. They get bored. I just spoke to a student who's a parent, and she said her child is bored because the child is so intelligent. The child is bored in the first grade and second grade and third grade because, you know, so it's like that. It's really like that.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm very glad that you are talking about this with such clarity, because everyone, it's become yoga, at least, and I keep telling you out here, because that's the world I operate in, but it's, everyone is trying to template it.
Yeah.
You know, which is why a lot of people walk away from practice, walk away from yoga, and yoga doesn't seem to work for them. And there's so much that we could get into about that particular aspect itself. But I'm very glad you're clarifying that it depends on who the person is, what context, yeah, where are they starting from. And I'm hoping that the listeners are hearing that. So you said something about, you know, the mind being very external, we have to engage it. So how does one engage this? When you say engage the mind through karma, are you indicating that someone should start with asana if they're very tamasic or rajasic, or how does one start this process?
See, ultimately you have to understand, what are we working on? We are working on the mind, number one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, what are we operating on? The mind. Okay, number one. Number two, what is our project with the mind? Two, number one, pull the mind from external focus to inward.
To internal, yeah, focus.
Mm-hmm. Number two, not just pull it, like not like take a animal from outside and put it in a cage. No, calm down that animal and focus that animal. So we are not just taking a U-turn of the mind and keeping a chaotic mind inside us. No, we are making a U-turn with the mind, and then the mind will be made to sit quietly, calm and centered, as I call it. Yeah, so that's our project, basically. Yeah. So now the eight limbs system of Patanjali is an attempt to involute an externalized mind, basically. Now, Yama, Niyama are practices for the most externalized mind. Why? Because my ultimate aim is what? The Chitta Vritti Nirodha.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure mm-hmm. we all know it. Chitta Vritti Nirodha, which is the definition of Patanjali. Patanjali says yoga is Chitta Vritti Nirodha.
Chitta Vritti.
That is mm-hmm. a cessation of all mental fluctuations. Now, when will all mental fluctuations cease? When no external trigger triggers them, right? No external or internal trigger triggers them. If anything and everything outside of you and inside of you is going to disturb your mind,
mm-hmm.
how will you reach samadhi? Understand this. And that's why we start with yama and niyama. So we start with the most external of the concentric circles, that is personal and social regulation. So we work on social and personal triggers. In modern language, we learn to become immune to the triggers, because our mind doesn't work in isolation, right? I mean, we are continuously being shaped,
so true. Mm-hmm.
shaped by our circumstances, our thoughts and situations. So if the mind has to be in Vritti Nirodha state, if a mind really has to be in a absolutely calm stage, it has to be calm in all possible stages. Not just in, it should not be like in Dhyana, you are like a saint, and when you come out of Dhyana, you are a psychopath. No, it should not be like that. So, Ashtanga Marga starts from outermost mind and progresses to inward state. So basically, what Patanjali has done is, Patanjali says, you want to do Chitta Vritti Nirodha, do it at all possible levels.
Got
you
it.
See, mm-hmm. now mm-hmm. you cannot just be calm in your dhyana and then outside you will be disturbed. No. If you say you are calm minded, you should be calm minded also when your flight is delayed.
Yes.
You should mm-hmm. be calm Nothing also should. When things mm-hmm. don't go your way. And you should also be calm when you are in dhyana. So that is why it is bahiranga and antaranga. External practices, which are first five, are external practices done with the body, with the mind. And last three, Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi, that is Patanjali calls it Samyama. The last three are internal practice. They're nothing to do with outside.
Mm-hmm.
So by that time, you're so calm and people, even if somebody is having a rave party inside your room, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't bother you. Yeah.
Doesn't bother you. You're gone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the yamas and niyamas, they start the eight limbs. And if I'm being very honest with you, and some of my questions here will seem naive because some of these are concepts that need so much exploration. Isn't it, or my understanding is, it's a lot easier to just go on your mat, do a few asanas, than actually live your yamas and niyamas. You know, I feel like that's it's a longer learning curve.
Absolutely.
And it's a lifelong thing.
I agree.
So it's essentially what I'm trying to remind the listeners is nothing is black or white. It's constant. Like these eight limbs, it's constant. You drop in, you drop out. You've got to be very intentional about this practice. So now, can we get into, so we'll if we put the yamas and niyamas aside, we put the asanas and pranayama. Well, let's look at asana and pranayama as the next chunk. And if I may bring them up together, can you contextualize the reason? Now, you and I know, we know what asana was originally meant for,
mm-hmm.
right? But in today's popular yoga world where yoga has just become asana in everybody's life, what was the traditional goal of asana in the eight-limbed framework? And where does pranayama come into that? Or how is pranayama associated with that? I don't know if these are good questions.
No,
these might just be terrible
questions. We are just having
questions.
A conversation, so it's okay. But I don't want to miss out on what you, I think, just slipped out of your mouth is yama niyama is difficult and asana is simpler, right? That's what you mentioned earlier.
I mean, yeah? On a very naive, if I look at
we
what people have
here.
Been sharing, I don't,
it's same experience for everybody. You know, because it is very easy to go on your mat, shut yourself and deal with your muscles.
Yes.
Rather than be in,
then deal with
in,
your mind.
In a triggered situation in social context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reason why, I wanted to take that point up because it's an important point. Because yama niyama is difficult for us because our mind is really not under our control, our regulation.
Yes.
We have to deeply understand this. You see, our mind is like, as one philosopher calls it, a ghost in a machine. It's its own person. See, things like triggers like anger, jealousy, people impulsively react to these triggers. So where is the self? Think about it. I mean, in sleep, we rattle some things that we have no idea. We wake up in the awakened state, somebody says one thing and, you know, road rage and things like that, or being upset, being triggered. How can we even say it's my mind when your mind is not even in your control? This is a realization that one has to literally bang their head on to really understand the profundity of what Yoga Sutra really is, that no matter how much we call ourselves the owner of our mind is not under our control. When we want to be happy, something happens and we are sad. Like interviews, we desperately want the job, but then we are nervous that we will not get the job. I mean, what is this?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's why it's definitely easier to do asana. I totally agree with you. Because in asana, we are in a controlled environment, you know. Mind has some
even
focus.
Even there, Prasad, even there, I mean, if I can interject for a moment, even the asana we do, right, it depends on our intention, right? Sometimes people, and I've been guilty of this, I'm on my mat completely mentally absent.
Yeah.
In my practice sometimes. And I catch myself in those states. And sometimes people will just distract themselves with music or instructions that are very external, you know, but not instructions that are more internal, like really taking you deeper into that state. So I hear you. I'm just, I don't know why I'm interrupting you with this, but
no,
yes.
No, I mean, you are right in the, absolutely. But again, that, like many people will come to asana to calm down their mind, not many people will go to a market to calm down their mind, right? Mm. So
yeah,
somewhere studio setup or going on your mat is a controlled environment. And that's why Yama Niyama is difficult.
Yeah.
Yama Niyama has to be practiced with at least one more person with you. And then that one more person becomes your trigger and then all hell breaks loose. So that's why Patanjali is like, hey, let's start with the basics. Yeah. So the Bahiranga, the first five limbs are actually circular. They are not linear. Yeah. Yama Niyama has to be practiced till your mind is one pointed.
Mm. But isn't that lifelong? That is constant.
Not one lifelong.
Many lives. Okay. Fair enough.
Understand. Patanjali's yoga system is not devised for 3 months, 6 months, 6 weeks program.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The evolution of mind that is happening, and Patanjali himself says it. If you read properly the Yoga Sutra, he has mentioned people who have worked in earlier lives and this and that, you know. So let's not look at Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga as a 3 month project or 200-hour project or 500-hour project. No.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
No.
There's no such thing. No.
Mm-hmm. You just walk. That's it. When will I reach? How much more time? None of your concern. This is how a real seeker, you know, just do for the sake of doing, not for the sake of reaching. Yeah, the goal is set. There's an idea of the goal, but there's no desperation. Because
it's not a checklist item.
No. Now, imagine if I'm desperate to reach my goal.
You will not reach it.
Yeah, but that flouts the santosha, no?
Mm-hmm.
You see how you get caught
Fair
up.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Like, so Patanjali is very smart. He says that you have to be intensely devoted. This is tivra samvegana. Intensely devoted and yet be content. So, you see, it's very nuanced.
Yes.
Yeah, Patanjali's. To really be honest, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra is not an entry-level scripture at all.
I completely agree.
It's not an entry-level scripture. And now in modern yoga, for some reason, we just start off with Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. I mean, we have all parachuted into Patanjali's yoga, you know, and you cannot understand Yoga Sutra without conceptual understanding of some terms or principles, you know.
Mm-hmm. So what would be an entry-level scripture? You mentioned that. So I'm just going to quickly see if we, what would be an entry-level scripture for teachers listening?
If I were to teach one scripture of what is popular now, I would rather start with Bhagavad Gita than with Patanjali's Yoga Sutra.
Okay, I was thinking you would say Bhagavad Gita. Okay,
yeah, because it is more accessible.
I completely understand why.
Because it is more, number one, it is not written in sutra format. Sutra format is like bullet points. And you cannot...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, sutra format literally means bullet points. And you cannot know the bullet points unless you know. Right? Bullet points is jargons. You cannot know the jargons unless you know the basics. And this is why what happens is we assume a lot of things in modern...
Exactly, yeah. And that's become such a big problem because you're interpreting it with your own understanding or lack of understanding. More lack of understanding than understanding.
Exactly.
And cultural context is missing, language barriers, all of that is involved.
And this is big, big, big thing. You know, this is why scriptures are misinterpreted. Scriptures need to be studied in context always because scriptures were written in context, like Bhagavad Gita. It has to be studied in context. Why the battle? Same way with the Yoga Sutra. And also the basis of Yoga Sutra is in Sankhya philosophy. Without the study of Sankhya philosophy, it's impossible to understand the nuance of Yoga Sutra. This is why I feel the popular discourse of Yoga Sutra. I mean, you know, we see Yoga Sutra, Yoga Sutra. Whenever you see something about Yoga Sutra is... It's maximum about Yama, Niyama or Asana. That's it. But there's so much to it, more than Yama, Niyama. In fact, I would say Yama, Niyama are the practices. They are not even the principles. But in popular understanding, and nothing wrong with it, I'm just pointing it out, Yama Niyama are very accessible and understandable. That's why people, they get a lot of traction. But we miss out on a lot of deeper wisdom. And I'm not saying that only few people are capable of understanding that deeper wisdom. No, not at all. No. Not at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Every person who suffers can understand what Patanjali is trying to say. So I am not from this idea that, not everybody is ready for the scripture. No, it really depends on the teacher. You know, if you find a good teacher, that so teacher true. Can mm-hmm. make even Brahmajnana, like the absolute knowledge also accessible. So I am not from the school of thought who sectionizes, but the student needs to have certain capability. Anyway, sorry to get just, go on a tangent, but
No, I love all
coming
this.
Coming back to your original question about asana, right? You had asked about asana. So Patanjali's asana, when Patanjali says asana, is meaning a seated position.
Mm-hmm.
So asana means a seat, even today. You know, you go to somebody's house in some regions in India, they say, asana le lo. So you don't immediately go into a triangle pose. When they say asan lo, like we say in India, in English, take your seat or take a seat,
mm-hmm.
take a seat. So it's literally that. So asana is a seat and seat for meditation. So when Patanjali says asana, he means a seat taken for meditation. And that seat needs to be steady. Now the movement asana that we practice these days, the postures and all that, they mainly originate from the Hatha and Tantra Marga. So, but in popular culture, we think that Patanjali has given us all these, mm-hmm. complex poses, but that's not the actuality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm glad you bring that up because it's so basic. Like this one understanding is so basic, but I have met countless teachers or spoken to countless teachers who don't know this because their teachers never knew it or didn't think it was important enough to really clarify this and went straight into here are the 100 type different asanas you should know. Hmm. So that's why.
Yeah, I mean, it happens in India too. Like people assume that that asana that Patanjali talks about, those are the mobile, all the complex postural things that we do. But they are not actually, they come from, like I said, we call it Hatha Kriya. These are Hatha, literal physical gross practices to make the mind steady. So the goal is the same. Ultimately, a Hatha yogi will sit for dhyana and Patanjali's yogi will also sit for dhyana. So goal is the
also
same
sit
again.
For dhyana. Mm-hmm.
But the credit of movement asana goes to Patanjali, which I find a little strange, and
movement
this,
asana?
The movement asana, all these mobile, like triangle warrior, this and that. Yeah.
No, I get it. Did you say movement asana credit goes to Patanjali?
Yeah. I mean, I have heard people say Patanjali was the originator of Surya Namaskars and all that.
Oh, okay.
So,
interesting. Okay.
Because for Patanjali, asana means sit down.
Correct.
And then sit down, make your body steady and relaxed, merge it with as much concept of or idea of infinity that you have,
mm-hmm.
Ananta Samapatti Bhyam, as he would say, and then start with your pranayama. So that's what Patanjali would say. Patanjali would not say roll out your mat and do these complex poses. That Gorakhnath would say, or some other Hatha yogi, Hatha margis would say.
I just heard it differently, so I was clarifying. Okay.
So in popular culture, we feel that ancient times everybody did asana.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like I've had people say, no, everybody did asana and you have to do asana.
So untrue. Mm-hmm.
But not really. Asana is a gateway to yoga, but everybody may not take that gate.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
Movement asana or this postural practice kind of asana was not popular as it is now in the ancient times. Neither was it mainstream, basically. Postures were practiced in secret. The postural practice that we do was practiced in secret. That's why even if you read Hatha Pradipika, it is mentioned. Go away from society, make your own hut and things like that. And they were practiced only in some lineages that emphasize Hatha Kriya. So all these are important things to know. You know, we cannot just slap one view on other person's ideology. That's not,
yes,
I think, fair.
This is just a quick update for the listeners. We did a whole episode with you on, yeah, what is Hatha Yoga.
Correct.
I will link to that in the show notes and in the podcast description so people can listen to that for further contextualization, because you went into depth of what is Hatha Yoga in that one. So now, moving us further along in the eight limbs here, I'm kind of skipping over pranayama, but if you want us to stop there, we absolutely can. But I want to bring up pratyahara.
Yeah.
Okay, sensory withdrawal. I feel like this limb has, at least from my little, you know, being present in these discussions and conversations, I feel this pratyahara gets kind of jumped over. It's like a neglected limb almost.
Yeah.
But I feel like in popular times with our overstimulation, it is one of the most important angas to look at.
Absolutely.
So can you talk a little more about how, is there a way we can make pratyahara a more conscious practice? Because a lot of times people can say, withdraw your senses, don't be distracted. But is there anything very tangible to practice?
Absolutely. This the term that you use, no? Conscious, this is important.
Mm-hmm.
Because for Patanjali, pratyahara is not shutting the sense organ. Understand this, okay? There is a sense organ. And there is a sense. Just because I shut my eyes doesn't mean I have no visions in front of my eyes. Think about it. Just because I shut my ears doesn't mean I don't hear anything. If my mind starts singing a song, I very well hear that song even if my ears are shut. So there are two levels of pratyahara here. One is at the gross level of shutting the sense organ. And the second level is shutting the sense impulse itself.
Mm.
Like okay. That's the difference between sight and vision. No? Sight is what you see, drishti. Yeah, sight is what you see. I open my eyes, I see you. Then you go away, then I close my eyes and I can still see you because as a vision, not as a sight. So pratyahara is also, you have to understand it at different levels. And why pratyahara is needed is because every exposure that we have through the senses will literally imprint itself on our mind.
Yes.
Think about it. And remember what was our original project? To calm down the mind.
Mm.
So you watched a horror movie and now you close your eyes and sit for meditation. Of course, you're going to...
You will see that. Yes.
You will see that. I mean, your meditation space with all the closed lights and no sound, conducive atmosphere for the horror movie to replay behind your shut eyes, no? So, like you said, pratyahara entails conscious reduction or withdrawal from sensory stimulation. Because the more restless the mind, the more it wants to get engaged in sensory stimulation. It's opposite. See, my mind is restless, so it moves outward. A restless mind is not going to sit quietly. Like a restless mind will not naturally go for salad. A restless mind will go for chips, chocolate, coffee. So a restless mind will always move out for some or other sensory stimulation.
Yes.
The more it wants to go outward, the more it's going anti-Patanjali's path. You see? Here, as a practice, we are trying to involute the mind and mind is going out. And it happens. Even modern commercial spirituality has become all about experience shopping. No? Experience this modality,
true,
experience come to my class, experience 25 types of meditation.
Like a sampler.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This holy place, that ritual, that mantra, that asana. So we've all become modern yoga has become a modality economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And because of service industry, it becomes incumbent on the yoga teacher to offer a wide range of services through hundreds of modalities.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in a way, modern practitioner is constantly being tempted to stay in outwardly state of mind, even though yoga per se is a journey of mind moving inward. So the most initial way, coming back to your original question, the most initial way I think pratyahara can be practiced in our modern senses would be to literally examine the excess of stuff we surround ourselves with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just saying clothes and shoes and all. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
I have 4 yoga teachers. I'm a member at 3 yoga studios. I'm doing 6 courses on one platform, and I'm reading 10 books. Why?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Why?
Why? Why? Because excess sensory mm-hmm. engagement is going to keep your mind buzzing, and Patanjali doesn't want our mind to buzz. A buzzing mind is neither conducive to pratyahara, nor to samadhi, nor to yoga. So at the very, very fundamental level, start inspecting, start reflecting on how much is too much. That's the question. How much is too much? And ask that question at every point. Do I really need these 30 postures? Do I really need 26 pranayamas? Do I really need 16 teachers? Do I really need to?
Yes.
On Monday, I study Vedanta. Tuesday, I study Patanjali. Wednesday, I study Tantra. Why?
Thursday, you won't remember any of it.
But I study everything, but I never study myself. Oops.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, this is really it's very hard hitting to me, and I love hearing it. Sometimes in my head, Prasad, I feel like if I could reorder this, and I'm nobody to reorder any of this, right? But I feel like in modern day, sometimes when students come to study with this, I want everything because they think that's how they should study. I feel like pratyahara should be the first limb.
Absolutely.
Right? To get them to simplify first.
Absolutely.
Like just take all your distractions out and then let's begin.
Bingo. Absolutely.
And because otherwise, and this happens in teacher trainings, and I'm sure you have seen this time and time again, people will be like, where's my reading list? Just last week, somebody asked me in pranayama training, I notice you don't give a reading list. Why? And I explained to them the same reason of it's not about just assimilating information.
Yeah.
You don't need more information. You need to sit with what we are doing and implement that in practice and absorb. And I was like, I do not give reading lists in anything. Okay, I will give you a reading list at the end based on a few different, you know, conditions that we'll look at, like which one do you want to go into? But just this thing of reading list. Honestly, nobody reads those 25 books you recommend anyway. Yes. So it's just you feel like you're doing something, but you're not really doing it is how I see it. Anyway, coming back off my tangent here. And for sake of time, and I know it's getting late for you, so I'm going to push us into dharana and dhyana.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you tell us what's the difference, right? Concentration,
dharana
meditation. Are they really different?
Yes, of course, they are different. There's a huge difference between them. Dharana is trying to. Dharana is the struggle. Dharana is an attempt. Dharana is working towards. There's a continuous tense there. So dharana is trying to keep the mind focused on a point of concentration. Desha bandhas chittasya dharana. Desha bandha, you know, trying to focus that mind. Trying to. So understand, dharana is trying to, an attempt. Dhyana is when that mind is concentrated. It's done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so dharana could be equated to trying to sleep, rolling from this shoulder to that and then taking one leg out and, you know, wrapping your head under the blanket and trying to.
Mm-hmm.
And sleep is dhyana, gone. Like we say, you know, oh, last night couldn't sleep 15 minutes. I was just tossing, turning, and then I was gone. Exactly that.
Got it.
Dharana is an attempt. So most of us, at least I, when we say I'm doing meditation, we are trying to meditate.
Not exactly.
Yeah, we are in the dharana. And that's okay. Nobody's in the first attempt itself, you crack samadhi, you cannot be like that. So dhyana is the ease and dharana is the attempt. Dharana is the action and dhyana is a state of mind. Remember that. Dhyana is not a practice. Dharana
is a practice. That's beautifully surprised.
Dharana is a practice and dhyana is a state of mind that you reach.
Mm-hmm. That is so well put. I have that really hits home. Okay. So again, now we're leaping forward. I wish I could spend another hour here asking you about things about dharana and dhyana and samadhi, but I will leave that for another conversation. But can we talk about samadhi here for a moment as we wrap this up? I'm going to leave it to you. Do you want to get into, I'll give you a couple of options and you can dismiss all these options and pick your own if needed. But do we want to talk about what people have misunderstood about samadhi, or do we want to get into its relevance for modern day practitioners? Okay. Or do we want to explore samadhi as a concept and the types of samadhi that Patanjali talks about, or anything else?
See, samadhi can be discussed, but it's a state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's like this. It's like people write volumes on love, but you have to fall in love, right? Just because you read romantic novels, you doesn't mean you will fall in love. You will convince yourself to fall in love, but love, yeah. Mm-hmm. Love is a state of being or state of mind, if you will. So I can read about samadhi and teach samadhi, this type and that type and layers of samadhi and states of samadhi, which is fair, which is all accepted principally, theoretically. But ultimately, it's a state of mind. It's a deep, profound state of mind. I mean, I told you that dhyana is a state of mind, right?
Yes.
Like mm-hmm. dharana is an action. Dhyana is a state of mind. And samadhi is when that state of mind reaches its peak.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's like dharana is I'm trying to get that job. Dhyana is I got that job. And samadhi is I got the best job. Or I became the CEO, kind of. Yeah. So we can discuss samadhi. You know, it's an extensive topic. But in brief, it is like what I stated, what I spoke about. You know, it's reaching a profound state of dhyana. There can be no samadhi without dhyana. Yeah, dhyana matures into samadhi. It's a state in which mind stands still in its complete potency without being disturbed by any samskaras, any condition. So just try to feel how that state would be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really it can be taught, but can't really discuss. Like it'll be like, you know, just trying to imagine how the surface of an undiscovered planet would be.
Yeah, no, I hear you. In fact, I almost put a disclaimer when I talk about the Ashtanga Marga when it comes to samadhi.
Yeah.
I'm like, I cannot talk to you about samadhi because there is no way in this or any other lifetime I will be able to do justice because it is an experiential state. I can only tell you what I have read about samadhi.
Perfect.
And you should talk to people who are really in that state or have clearer understanding, because it's not something I am qualified to, you know, really talk about. So I just tell them that samadhi is a state that I am not capable of even, you know, explaining. I can just tell you what I have read.
Yeah, I mean,
and what is available in information.
Like, you know, you can say for Patanjali, samadhi is like this, like this, like this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, anybody is capable of samadhi. Yeah, let's not write off anybody, including you or I, you or me. There are many modern practitioners who I know personally who have experienced high states of samadhi and yet are able to function in the world. Yeah, so it's not like samadhi is only for somebody who's sitting in a cave or under a 9-foot.
No, I hear you.
Yeah, so let's not, you know, anything can happen.
But right? Doesn't it come down to the types of samadhi, right?
Correct. But still, it's a samadhi. Even the most basic samadhi can hit you off so amazingly.
Uh-huh.
But that's why these are stages. No? The first initial state of samadhi, according to Patanjali, is like an intense ecstatic feeling. You know, and then you come out of it and you're like, I'm out of it. But that's like a little teaser, you know, little sampler. You know, like you get on those
gelato shops. So you go back for
shops.
More. Uh-huh. Yes, yeah. For the listeners who don't know, Prasad loves ice cream,
yeah,
like
so,
maybe a little too much.
So you eat one spoon and then you decide what to eat. Yeah. So let me again,
fair enough.
As one goes deeper in samadhi, one needs this is why you need a teacher. You know,
yes.
You and I always talk mm-hmm. about this. That's why we need a teacher, you know, because all eight limbs 100%. Are relevant and needed mm-hmm. for modern practitioners. But modern practitioners have a lot of unregulated mind. And that's why a teacher is needed, a proper teacher. So I would recommend, again, find your teacher.
Teacher acts as a filter. Mm-hmm. This has come up in all our conversations.
Yeah, because refined states of yoga can't be handled individually. Yeah, one needs guidance, one needs support, one needs assurance of a teacher who has walked that path.
That lived experience.
Yeah, mm-hmm. at least the teacher can empathize with you. You know, I understand your frustration, but keep trying. Just that much validation is good enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and it's that support is very important. It's not a do-it-yourself project.
Not at all. I mean, initially you can struggle with yama, niyama and all, but later, as your mind refines, you need a teacher. You really need a guru, not even a teacher. Huh?
Yes.
A guru. Like, teacher will teach and go away.
Correct. Guru, a teacher can only get you that far.
Guru mm-hmm. is guidance and support system. That's a different level of commitment.
True. So true. No, this is, I mean, I can ask you 20 other questions about things you've just said in your samadhi response, but I'll just leave it out there that maybe one day we'll do an episode where we explore samadhi itself as a conversation.
Yeah.
And if you are willing to indulge me for the, I don't know, 5th, 6th, 10th time. But as we wrap up, any final thoughts, or have we covered most of it for this conversation?
Yeah, I think one important point here is that yoga is ultimately a path of withdrawal. Yeah, it's a moksha marga.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that we need to deeply realize, that yoga is ultimately a path of gradually moving inward. Yeah? Not complete detachment, but at least slowly letting go of all most things that hold you back. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's mm-hmm. why Patanjali talks about abhyasa and vairagya. Abhyasa is practice and vairagya is detachment. But most of what we hear nowadays is only abhyasa. Do your practice, do your practice. Who tells you do practice detachment? Hardly anybody.
No, sometimes I actually hear detachment also. But if I may say this, and I say this respectfully, it's very selective detachment.
Correct.
You know, it's like detach from X, Y, and Z, but attached to A, B, and C because that's more important. It's very selective.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to say this in a refined way, but it happens a lot in the yoga world. Just selective detachment.
Yeah, you're actually right. You know, so detach from one personality of you and then attach to another personality.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. that is like Asmita, no? We've studied Asmita. So detach from one Asmita and attach to another Asmita. It's still Asmita. You know, still keeps you in the
correct
ignorance. But usually I'm saying, you know, there's so much emphasis on practice, but not as much emphasis on withdrawal or letting go or vairagya. Because somewhere modern spirituality is based on consumerism. So they will not ask you to
become a commodity.
Commodity. Mm-hmm. Commodification. So they will not ask you to detach. You know, they don't want to kill their own, business model.
Business. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yoga is ultimately, the way I look at detachment is yoga is ultimately about simplifying life and uncomplicating your mind. So for me, detachment is all about how I simplify my life and how I uncomplicate my mind. And that has been my attempt in my life since last couple of decades. You know, because if we keep swimming in seas of objects and stimulations and triggers and experiences without stepping back from sensory experiential stimulation, yoga won't work. And that's why we need to equally focus on vairagya and not just practice. Yeah, and that's why, like you said, simplification is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Lightening up is important.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you for this. This has been very insightful. I always tell people that the yogis made it simple. We are complicating
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad that teachers like you are constantly honing that message in through all that you do. You are no stranger to this podcast. So as always, I will link to everything you put out on Instagram, those daily reflections that you make all of us do through the work that you put out, your trainings, all of that. And I will.
I want to leave your audience with one small, affirmation I gave to some of my students in Mumbai, I think 12, 13 years ago.
Sure.
It's called simplify to simply fly.
Ah, uh-huh.
And that's it. Simplify to simply fly. I know it means nothing, but still it conveys the idea.
No, it means a lot actually. Yes, yes.
Yeah, so, and it, some students are even today holding on to that one little statement to just come back to, you know, making their life simple, you know, making life simple and making mind uncomplicated. And that's it really. That's all that yoga is.
Mm, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. I will say one quick thing here before we close this today is people say, oh, I do want to study more yoga because they think it means doing more, but it's the opposite.
Absolutely.
It means doing less.
Absolutely.
And that is so fundamentally misunderstood. But I'm glad you gave us simplify to simply fly. Thank you so much, Prasad.
Thank you so much.
It's always a really wonderful conversation.
Always great to, like you said, we could go on and on, but perhaps next time. So I'm inviting myself.
Yes,
again.
I should let you. Yes. Yes, you, the way I see it, I just take it for granted. I'm like, when are you coming back? So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And I look forward to having you back. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening. Please make sure you get on our email list so we can send you updates about anything that is new in terms of content creation. This means whenever a new podcast episode has dropped or when I write blogs and continuing education resources for yoga teachers, which I do often. They all go up on the blog, so we can put it straight in your inbox. If you sign up for our email list, just go to the link in the podcast description to find your way to that. Okay. I'll also occasionally update you when there is a new training coming up. We've got some free workshops coming up in 2023. So if you want to stay in the loop and not really rely on just Instagram and algorithms, then just make sure you get on that email list. Okay. As always, everything in today's episode has been linked at letstalk.yoga/listen. I will see you next week with another guest and a whole new conversation. Until then, enjoy your practice. Take care. Bye-bye.